I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Hello, this is Mike Swanson, and in a few moments, you're going to listen to another segment of Parallax Views. But before you do that, let me tell you about my new book, Why the Vietnam War. It's a sequel to my previous book called The War State, which has lots of positive reviews and Amazon's been out for years. But this one is a more detailed case study of how American empire, national security state operate using Vietnam. And I believe it shows also how things work today, how policy is actually made and why. So grab the book on Amazon.com, Why the Vietnam War.
Hey there, Parallax Views listeners. On this edition of the program, we continue our exploration of the Israel-Palestine conflict and its latest, rather intense and I would say tragic, developments. This time with University of San Francisco International Relations scholar, Dr. Stephen Zunis. This is a fairly wide-ranging conversation that deals with a number of topics related to the conflict, including the recent Israeli airstrikes in Gaza, the question of war crimes, the Biden administration's response to the current flare-ups in the conflict, and Dr. Zunis's opinions on the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee. Now, Dr. Zunis is wary of assigning too much influence to AIPAC. I think there can be debate about AIPAC and its influence in Washington, D.C., although I do share his concern about the ways in which AIPAC can be turned into an anti-Semitic canard. As I mentioned in the course of our conversation. All that and much more on this edition of Parallax Views. And now on to the conversation with Dr. Stephen Zunis. Welcome to Parallax Views, Stephen Zunis, a professor at the University of San Francisco and a longtime commentator on issues pertaining to U.S. foreign policy. How are you doing today?
Very good, thank you.
So I wanted to have you on the program to discuss the current issue we see with the Israel-Palestine conflict and the U.S. role in conflicts like this. I guess first, what is your basic view of what is happening right now in Israel and Palestine?
Well, basically, we see both Hamas and the Israelis violating basic norms of international humanitarian law by firing deadly projectiles into civilian populated areas. The Israelis, of course, with a superior firepower, are inflicting far, far greater damage. I mean, the disproportionality is just extreme. We're talking 20 to 1, at least, in terms of casualties. And I think given that, you know, the United States is the provider of many of the weapons and delivery systems that are being used in the slaughter, that the United States bears a special responsibility. The United Nations Security Council has been meeting to try to at least issue a statement that would help lead to a ceasefire, but the United States has blocked all three initiatives so far. These were supported by all 14 other members of the Security Council. I mean, it's literally 14 to 1, the United States alone in blocking its passage. So and we've heard President Biden, as well as leading members of Congress of both parties, correctly criticizing the Hamas rocket attacks, but largely defending what Israel's doing, even claiming that it's all in self-defense.
I wanted to ask about the matter of the UN a bit more, because I've seen people try to attack the UN as being anti-Israel, and I really think that couldn't be farther from the truth. They seem very balanced in what they've said so far.
Well, certainly the draft resolutions, I can't comment on every single resolution passed by the General Assembly over the past 70 years, but certainly what we have seen in terms of the Security Council's actions, France and Britain were among Israel's strongest supporters in its early days. And similarly, if you look down the list of the members of the Security Council, these are not historically, with one or two exceptions, hardline opponents of Israel. They're not saying Israel doesn't have a right to exist. They're not saying Zionism is evil. They're not, they're not saying Israel doesn't have a right of self-defense or anything like that. The resolutions themselves, explicitly condemn what Hamas is doing, but they happen to criticize Israel as well. And that's the part that the Biden administration is objecting to.
With regards to the Biden administration's initial response, the response has more or less been Israel has a right to defend itself. And I think we've heard that in the past before, and there's not really a mention of the Palestinians. Why do you think that is? What's the reason for this being the sort of go-to response?
It's kind of odd because, of course, Israel has the right to defend itself. Every country has the right to defend itself. I mean, that's not a question. I think the reason they keep saying that is they want to try to make the case that bombing high concentrations of civilian population in which there may be a number of alleged terrorists within their midst somehow constitutes legitimate self-defense. And that's a very, very dangerous position. The fact that even when pressed, State Department spokespeople have declined to say that the Palestinians have a right to self-defense. Now, lobbing rockets randomly in Israel is not legitimate self-defense either. But the fact that the U.S. can be so clear in defending Israel's right to exist and Israel's right to self-defense, and being ambivalent about the Palestinians' right of self-defense is not just being one-sided. I think it even be argued as racist, frankly, because it is really saying that one people have less right to defend themselves than the other based on their ethnicity. I think one could actually call that racist.
But why would the U.S. want to be framing it that way? As you said, this seems to be a pretty dangerous game. What's at play here?
I'd say a number of things. On one hand, we've seen this kind of one-sidedness before. I mean, anybody who knows the history of U.S. foreign policy certainly can look at all the times, past and present, where the United States has raised concerns about human rights abuses by governments we don't like, and then minimize or ignore or cover them up if committed by governments that we support. I mean, obviously, those of us who were around in the 1980s remember in Central America how the United States would cover up for the right-wing death squads and the military juntas that the U.S. supported, while condemning and sometimes even exaggerating human rights abuses, by leftist governments and leftist movements. But what's disturbing is that when it comes to Israel and Palestine, there are even liberal members of Congress who will fall into this kind of double standard. Part of it is that if the United States was frank about Israeli violations of international humanitarian law, which in a number of cases do constitute war crimes, it could put pressure to cut back on the lucrative arms industry. The so-called U.S. aid to Israel, which is at $3.8 billion a year, they don't go to the ordinary Israelis. I mean, 80% of that goes to U.S. arms manufacturers. And And so, you know, we can say, oh, it's all defensive weaponry if everything Israel does is in self-defense. So therefore, it's legitimate. Therefore, it doesn't apply to the Leahy law and other restrictions that would limit arms transfers in those cases. And I think there's a depending on the on who's saying it, I mean, there are a number of forces that are pushing in that direction. You know, you have certain you have the tens of millions of right-wing evangelical Christians who see the struggle between Israelis and Palestinians as a continuation of the struggles between Israelites and Philistines, and they're very clear on whose side God is supposedly on. You have, you know, certain older generation of liberals who have a kind of sentimental attachment to Israel back in its early days when it was, you know, more progressive than it is now. And
especially due to like the Six Day War and the memory of that, right?
Yeah. Again, concern about the fate of the Jewish people. I mean, you know, if there's only one black state in the world and they're engaged in human rights abuses, you know, there'd be plenty of African-American, some white liberals who might be a little defensive that people criticize them because you have to wonder why are they criticizing it really, you know, and then there's certain elements within the American liberalism that has a similar, you know, view around Israel. There's certainly AIPAC and some of the right-wing, pro-Israel groups that put, you know, a degree of political pressure on members of Congress and the media. Personally, I think that while their role is not insignificant, I would caution people to act like that's the only reason the United States is backing Israel, because as I noted earlier, the U.S. is certainly supported, defended regimes that commit even worse atrocities than the Israelis do. I mean, Congress has on many cases for unconditional military aid to dictatorships that have slaughtered, you know, more civilians than Israel ever has, and it wasn't, they didn't need an ethnic lobby to force their hand to do so, But AIPAC and those guys are certainly one factor to consider. But I think also, unfortunately, I don't think there's been as much of a move within the peace and human rights community, at least in some sectors. There's a reluctance to really push back on this. I mean, I if you think of, groups like Move On, Progressive Democrats of America, even explicit peace groups like Peace Action, you know, they... to whatever extent they take positions on Israel-Palestine, they're pretty reasonable, but they usually don't use this as a criteria for endorsements. I mean, these groups have endorsed members of Congress who, while, you know, fairly progressive in some foreign policy issues, some domestic issues, are going whole hog in support of Netanyahu on this issue. And, you know, it seems to me that if peace and human rights and international law is a concern of yours, it should be across the board, and don't make exceptions, for Israel. I mean, just as Israel shouldn't be unfairly singled out for criticism, they shouldn't be unfairly allowed to get away with stuff that other governments, shouldn't do. So I think another factor is that I don't think that the mainstream peace and human rights community has been made this as big a priority as it should. It shouldn't be just up to the more hardcore Palestine solidarity groups and a few left-leaning Jewish groups to carry the weight. I think it really needs to be more of a mainstream, you know, peace kind of issue. So at least the politicians will get pressure from two directions instead of just one.
Speaking of the mainstream, I'm sure you saw the John Oliver episode where he talked about this issue. What did you make of that? Do you think things like that are, you know, showing that there may be a changing of the tide in terms of how we talk about these issues?
Oh, there's definitely a real shift. And a lot of the shift actually is generational. Indeed, I've seen very few political issues, speaking as a political scientist, where age and political attitude parallel so closely. I mean, with a possible exception of LGBTQ issues, you know, I don't have any issue where one's age is a pretty as clear an indicator as one's views on average. Of course, it's just average on a particular issue. And younger Americans, especially younger American Jews, you know, take a more balanced or even somewhat pro-Palestinian position relative to their elders, who take a more hardline pro-Israel perspective. And we're starting to reflect that. I mean, you know, back when there are only like, you know, three networks that you got the news, you know, ABC, CBS, NBC, that in terms of getting the broadcast news. And of course, now people can get news from a lot of places. And it includes, you know, kind of alternative kind of perspectives. John Oliver, you know, probably, you know, even now could probably not quite get away with that on the major networks. But, you know, on cable, YouTube, things that you know, there is a little more diversity. And that may be one reason. In fact, some younger people who are less prone to the more, you know, traditional sources are able to develop, you know, somewhat more independent thinking on this issue. What's interesting, though, is that speaking of polling, I've also haven't seen many issues where there's such a huge gap between the rank and file and the politicians. The majority of Americans, including 80% of Democrats, believe that U.S. military aid to Israel should be conditional on Israel upholding basic principles of human rights and international law. Whereas the majority, and not only the Biden administration, rejects this idea. In fact, Biden went as far as saying that idea was crazy when Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren and Pete Buttigieg and some of his opponents were raising this idea. But 125 Democratic House members, you know, saw a majority of the Democratic caucus signed a letter just a few weeks ago insisting that U.S. military aid to Israel remain unconditional. And so, you know, there is this this huge gap between the politicians and the people who end up electing them to office. And this is really and you know, again, this, in the Democratic Party, this gap is pretty clear.
So since I mentioned the John Oliver segment on, you know, the current tensions and what is occurring right now, there was a point where they referenced a figure in the IDF that said, you know, the Palestinians, the Gazans have their own Iron Dome. It's called Don't Shoot Missiles at Us. Hamas can't shoot missiles at us. I was wondering how you respond to that, because I think that it's a violation for Hamas to, you know, be shooting missiles. But at the same time, when Palestinian civilians, including children, are getting hit, I don't think you can excuse that either.
Yeah. I mean, certainly. I mean, obviously, lobbying these rockets into Israel is not only a war crime, but I mean, politically, it is counterproductive. It is immoral. I mean, all these sorts of things. I think again, it doesn't, but it's not the people of Gaza that are firing these. It's these militiamen with Hamas and Islamic Jihad who do not have the support of the majority of Gazans. And it is the people of Gaza who are the ones who are suffering disproportionately. The vast majority of casualties have been civilians, not Hamas fighters or Hamas officials. And what Israel, like Hamas, is committing war crimes. But I think one of the real important things that John Oliver emphasized, and Trevor Noah on The Daily Show did this as well in a very, very clear manner, is to emphasize the gross asymmetry in power between Hamas and the Israeli Defense Forces. And that's one of the big problems of U.S. foreign policy in general. We've blocked the United Nations from doing anything. You know, not just in terms of the recent fighting, but in terms of the peace process as well, insisting that it should be in direct talks between the Israelis and Palestinians. But that ignores the gross asymmetry in power between the occupier and those under occupation. I mean, that's like saying, oh, you know, there shouldn't be any pressure or sanctions against Russia for occupying Crimea. This is up for negotiations between the Crimeans and Russians to decide whether Russia should withdraw or not. Or back when Iraq occupied Kuwait in the early 90s, it should be between the Iraqis and Kuwaitis to decide whether Iraq should keep that country under occupation. Let's keep it out of the UN or et cetera. And So I think that, you know, even if one takes the position that both Israeli Jews and Palestinian Arabs both have the right to statehood, both have the right to self-determination, both have the right to security, et cetera, et cetera. You know, the fact is that Israel is by far the most powerful armed force in the region, by far the biggest economic power in the region. And the Palestinians, both Hamas and the Palestine Authority, you know, are incredibly weak. You know, they are suffering under siege and occupation. And you really, it's not a fair fight by any means. And you know, we should say yes, both sides are wrong in the sense of attacking each other's territories without regard to you know, civilian lives. But we need to also keep into account, one, the enormously more destructive firepower of the Israelis, but also look at the conflict in itself in a broader sense as also a grossly asymmetrical conflict. And the problem is that the United States has this contradictory role of being both the primary military, financial, and diplomatic supporter of one of the two parties, the more powerful of the two parties by far, while at the same time insisting that we, not the United Nations, not the European Union, you know, not the broader international community, should be the sole mediator of the conflict. Anybody who studied conflict resolution, you know, knows that you cannot be, you know, both the mediator and be so strongly on one side, particularly the more powerful of the two sides.
So that brings me to, I guess, the claim that some are hearing in Washington that Hamas is using human shields as defined by international humanitarian law. And I think you actually talked about this on your own social media page. Why did you want to address that on your social media? And what was your basic point about that claim?
Well, a couple of points. Human shields, as defined by international law, is when a party to a conflict, an armed conflict, deliberately places civilians against their will as a you know, between them and the and their opponent, you know, as an effort to try to deter attack or, you know, deter, you know, military operations of one side or another. This is a charge that's been used against Hamas both in the 2009 war and the 2014 war, and is being used again. Now, investigations by Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, the United Nations, you know, looked into this, and they did not find a single case, not one, of Hamas using human shields as defined by the Fourth Geneva Convention. Now, they did find cases where Hamas broke a number of other principles of international humanitarian law, including lobbing shells into Israel, and including having some of their forces near you know, too close to where civilians were than they should have. But that's also a violation of international humanitarian law, but that's not as serious a crime as human shields, which is actually considered a crime against humanity, a far greater offense according to international law. But if you read the Fourth Geneva Convention, let's say Hamas is using human shields, you know, by the legal definition, that still does not give Israel the right to attack civilians, because it says even if, you know, even if somebody does do that, it doesn't mean that you can, you know, attack people. I mean, just for example, use a domestic example. Let's say that there's a botched bank robbery and the robbers are holding customers and tellers hostage, and they're shooting, you know, out the they're shooting at the police and other people out in the street from behind these people that they are holding hostage. It would not be considered appropriate for the SWAT team or the police or whatever to then go and gun down everybody, including the hostages, and then say, oh, it's not our fault. They're using human shields. So, you know, this human shield line is basically, it's impossible, you know, to deny that Israel's killing large number of civilians. But in bringing this up, they're saying, well, yes, but it's not the fault of the people who are killing them. It's the fault of their fellow Palestinians that they are dying. And really, this just does not hold up to scrutiny, you know, based both on the facts on the ground, but does not hold up in terms of international humanitarian law.
And I wanted to come back, if I could,
just briefly to the what you mentioned earlier about sort of redefining self-defense to include just wholesale bombing of civilian population centers. That seems like a very dangerous precedent, even beyond the Israel-Palestine conflict. Would you agree with it?
Definitely. And indeed, one of the least reported atrocities in U.S. foreign policy in recent years has been the heavy U.S. bombing of Raqqa in Syria and West Mosul in Iraq, which were controlled by ISIS, in which thousands of people died. And many of us predicted, in fact, this would be the case back in 2014 when Congress passed a resolution giving unconditional support for Israel's 2014 offensive in Gaza, where they effectively redefined the term human shields to include the line in the resolution basically said Hamas has used human shields by placing their fighters and leaders in civilian neighborhoods, civilian hospitals, and civilian mosques, implying that therefore, these were legitimate targets. But the civilian officials in Hamas, like other government officials anywhere, tend to live in civilian neighborhoods, go to civilian hospitals, go to civilian houses of worship. And certainly because Hamas is a militia, not a standing army, their fighters tend to live at home and go to the same hospitals and the same mosque and same neighborhoods as everybody else. So in a sense, what this resolution did, which was passed by an overwhelming bipartisan majority, is that they are basically saying that if an identified terrorist group has any fighters in a city or in an area, or an organization that we define as terrorists has civilian officials within a population, these are free fire zones. These are areas where the attacking force, especially in these cases where they have vastly superior firepower by land, sea, and air, can kill as many people as they want to, but they can say, oh, it's not our fault because the other side was using human shields.
I wanted to discuss what happened with the Associated Press building. But the larger point I also want to get at is it seems like in some ways there's been a blaming collateral damage for being collateral damage at this point. Well, you're responsible for being collateral damage. You shouldn't have been at the wrong place at the wrong time. It seems like that's going on in some ways.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, and for example, I've been blowing up the building that housed the Associated Press, Al Jazeera, and others. The Israelis insisted that it was a legitimate target because there is this Hamas military intelligence unit in the building. But, that's ridiculous on a number of levels. First of all, the people who lived in the building, the people who had offices, and it was also a big residential tower as well. The people who lived in the building, the reporters at Al Jazeera, AP, and elsewhere, found no evidence whatsoever of any kind of Hamas activity. And again, these reporters, they tend to notice things like that. And similarly, they'd be crazy to put their offices in a place, like that, because they know it would likely be that kind of target. If there were intelligence operations, Hamas would not want to have it there, because again, with reporters snooping around, doesn't seem like a particularly good place to have a military intelligence unit. And indeed, the State Department has acknowledged that they've seen, no evidence whatsoever. I think it's pretty much an open secret that the Israelis targeted this building because Al Jazeera and Associated Press were broadcasting and sending out information about what was happening on the ground, namely the large-scale targeting of civilians, which countered the U.S.-Israeli narrative that it was all this is legitimate self-defense, and they wanted to try to silence or at least limit the media as much as possible from reporting this kind of thing.
That actually brings me to the issue of how the media has been covering this issue recently, this sort of reignited conflict. I think there has been, more coverage in a balanced way in some ways, but then I've also seen things that I find a little bit off-putting. I just found an article in The Guardian, and it was admittedly an op-ed piece. I think it was by Simon Tisdale, that was talking about who is to blame for what is occurring right now. And it talked about how some people are saying this is all part of an Iranian plot. And other people are saying it's a plot by Netanyahu. And to me, that's all very speculative and very unhelpful and just fueling conspiracy theories.
Yeah, I mean, the Iranian role in all this is grossly exaggerated. I mean, the Iranians do have some influence with Hezbollah, which is the Shia militia. I mean, they have sophisticated missiles that are actually quite accurate and can hit anywhere in Israel, far more lethal or accurate or anything than the Hamas rockets, which are mostly made in machine shops in Gaza itself. I mean, if Iran was really supporting Hamas, at least in any big way, they would have far more sophisticated and deadlier projectiles to fire in Israel's direction. I mean, there is some speculation, primarily among Israelis, that it was Netanyahu who helped goad on these far right-wing Israeli settler groups that were attacking Palestinians in East Jerusalem and were seizing their homes in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood, which provoked Palestinian protests, which then led to some really brutal repression by Israeli occupation forces, which then led Hamas to fire its initial rockets, which then led Israel to start the airstrikes, which led Hamas to have even more rockets, which led Israel to have even more intensive airstrikes, et cetera, et cetera. Remember that Netanyahu and his rivals are trying to cobble together some kind of working coalition government after inconclusive Israeli elections. You know, there may be something to that. I don't know. My Israeli friends probably know more about that than I do. Yeah, but the thing is, we've seen this before. And in 2009 and 2014, some more minor flare-ups in between. And, it just underscores that, Gaza Strip has essentially been under siege, for 15 years. And when you have a territory in which people cannot come and go freely, where they cannot engage in normal kind of commerce, that is, legally speaking, an occupied territory. Even though Hamas may be the administrative power in there, since they forcibly seized the territory from the Palestine Authority back in 2005, it is under occupation. And in these horrific conditions, Hamas, which is a pretty reactionary, authoritarian organization, has been willing to impose its will on the Palestinian people there. They've crushed the teachers' union. They've shut down human rights activists, feminist groups. I mean, they're Hamas is bad news any way that you look at it. But the fact that the Hamas, ended up taking over Gaza goes back to an effort by the Bush administration to encourage Fatah to have a coup to oust the democratically elected Palestinian parliament, in which Hamas had a small a majority, which led to the Hamas counter coup in Gaza, et cetera. But overall, it goes down to the failure of enabling the more moderate Palestine Authority to be able to show success of having a viable, independent Palestinian state. Because, basically, Hamas was able to say to the Palestinians, hey, look, Fatah, the PLO, the Palestine Authority leadership, they promised that in giving up the armed struggle and giving up our dream for liberating all of Palestine, we could have the 22% of Palestine that Israel conquered in 1967 as a Palestinian mini state. But instead, with U.S. acquiescence, they have seen the Israelis colonize much of the West Bank, leaving the Palestinian control into these smaller and smaller urban enclaves surrounded by these illegal settlements and checkpoints just to go from one town to another, drying up the aquifers, controlling movement, commerce, et cetera, et cetera. And it's let Hamas to say, we told you so. You can't trust the Israelis. You shouldn't have trusted the United States to be the honest broker. We need to go for broke and we need to liberate all of Palestine. Well, of course, Hamas is not going to liberate Palestine. Not only would that be physically impossible in terms of the Israelis, but most Palestinians don't want to live under an Islamic state that Hamas wants to install. But one can understand how this kind of appeal did give rise to support for extremism. Because when the Oslo Accords were signed back in 1993, Hamas had barely 10-15% support among the Palestinians. And as the peace process dragged on and things got worse and worse, they went up to 45%, almost 50%. They've probably gone down a little bit as a result of their misrule in Gaza. But every time there's a war like this, their approval rating goes up again. And again, this is one of the many tragedies of this conflict. It's been encouraging the hardliners in both Israel and Palestine.
I also, if we could, I wanted to talk a little bit about, for lack of a better term, the alternative media and its coverage of the Israel-Palestine conflict, because we mentioned AIPAC earlier, and sometimes I feel that people really grossly misuse and exaggerate AIPAC in a way where, well, I'll just put it bluntly, I think some people have fallen into talking about AIPAC, the Israel lobby, in the way that really far-right anti-Semitic elements, sort of Buchanan types, talk about, you know, they used to call it Zionist-occupied government, Jewish conspiracism.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with this concern, actually, because I think the, as I noted earlier, that the United States has supported even worse governments that have engaged in even worse atrocities. Currently, the United States supports Morocco's occupation of Western Sahara. In fact, the Trump administration officially recognized Morocco's illegal annexation of Western Sahara, despite the fact that Western Sahara is a full member state of the African Union that's been recognized by over 80 governments in the world. And, you know, essentially saying Western Sahara has no right to exist. I mean, at least when it comes to Palestine, we give lip service to a two-state solution. But, you know, Western Sahara, you know, the U.S. and Biden hasn't reversed his policy. You know, as of today, you know, U.S. still sees occupied Western Sahara as sovereign Moroccan territory. That's what it looks like on the State Department maps and everything like that. If you go back 22 years, the United States was supporting Indonesia's occupation of East Timor, an occupation that wiped out one third of that island nation's population, over 200,000 people. And, and there wasn't an Indonesian-American lobby or Moroccan-American lobby that was forcing us to do these kinds of things. I mean, the unfortunate reality is the United States is perfectly capable of invading, occupying, colonizing, and oppressing. I mean, United States is willing to support an ally, do all these sorts of things, without some kind of ethnic lobby forcing our hands to do so. And what's disturbing is that you often hear, politicians always off the record saying, oh, we understand, but, we're getting all this pressure, whatever. And it falls into the all anti-Semitic stereotype. Oh, it's not our fault. It's that rich cabal of Jews behind the scenes that are really, pulling the strings. And that feeds the old anti-Semitic, kind of tropes that are so so dangerous. And I really, really think we need to challenge this idea of exceptionalism in Israel-Palestine. It is far, this follows a pattern of U.S. Foreign policy that goes back many, many decades of supporting these governments that are seen as strategic allies. And that's what the support of Israel is about, ultimately. I mean, I talked about the religious right, I've talked about the sentimental attachment for Israel, et cetera, but the main reason is the same reason we support any government. We see it as advancing U.S. interests. Israel is, in the words of one former Secretary of State, our unsinkable aircraft carrier. Israel, unlike some of our Arab allies, is not going to fall to a revolution or a coup. They're going to still be on our side. They're technologically advanced, unlike these other countries. The military-industrial complexes of the two countries are very closely intertwined. They can pass on U.S. arms to pro-Western governments and pro-Western insurgencies, including those for political reasons we can't send arms to directly. And this goes back to apartheid South Africa, Guatemalan junta, Nicaraguan Contras, more recently, various Kurdish militia, Colombian paramilitaries. The Mossad and CIA collaborate in intelligence gathering, covert operations. I mean, there are all sorts of reasons that the U.S. supports Israel. It has nothing to do with AIPAC. Now, where AIPAC does have and other right-wing Zionist groups do have influence is that I think there'd be more dissent if it weren't for AIPAC. I mean, I think the votes on these various resolutions defending Israeli policies would not be quite as one-sided as they are. I think academics like myself would not be blacklisted and censored in certain ways that we are. I mean, I think in certain ways they have limited debate in certain ways. But there's a big difference between limiting debate and determining a policy from scratch. U.S. policy would be more or less the same, even if it were not for the Zionist lobby. But there would be more debate. There would be more dissent. We'd have a somewhat easier time at reversing the policy. But the idea that the United States would suddenly have a policy towards Israel-Palestine that supports human rights, supports international law, that supports the United Nations, that supports arms control. I mean, come on, when has the United States had that kind of policy consistently anywhere?
And I just wanted to add two small points to that. I think, you know, AIPAC may have a role in certain things, as you pointed out, but the thing is, it's also not the only lobby in Washington. I mean, there's the Turkish lobby, which for years has sort of pushed back against any recognition of the Armenian genocide. And not only that, but I think I look at some of the talk about the Israel lobby on elements of the left, where it's seen as this omnipotent force. And to me, it just seems like a mirror image of how the Glenn Becks of the world talk about the Council on American Islamic Relations as being a giant Muslim mafia plot. And it's not good.
No, it's not good at all. And also what's interesting is that, you know, there are now two big Zionist lobby groups in Washington. One, of course,
J Street, right?
It's also J Street, which is a more left-leaning pro-Israel lobby. And it's been interesting to see things in the past few days where J Street has really been pushing for a ceasefire while AIPAC and the Biden administration are opposing it. So you know, which Zionist lobby are you talking about? If you say Biden and Congress is controlled by the Zionist lobby, well, which Zionist lobby? I mean, Biden and a good chunk of Congress is to the right of J Street, which in terms of membership is nearly as big as AIPAC. In fact, if you poll American Jews politically, far more American Jews are closer to J Street than they are to AIPAC. So you know, let's. So again, I think it's very, very dangerous I don't consider myself a Zionist, but I do recognize that Zionism is diverse. You have Zionists to support Netanyahu, but you have Zionists in Israel right now. They're out protesting the slaughter going on in Gaza. You have self-proclaimed Zionists who are in Israeli prisons for refusing to serve in the occupied territories. That we should not look at Zionism as a monolith. Now, again, The more left-leaning Zionists are a minority. Overall, Israel has been moving more and more to the right in recent years. But the Zionist movement as a whole is getting more chauvinistic, getting more militaristic, is getting more racist, et cetera, et cetera. But that is not all of what Zionism is. That's not the only Zionism. So to use Zionist, you know, as a catch-all phrase for everything that is that evil that the Israeli government is doing, I think is really an unfair representation. It does, you know, indeed parallel certain anti-Semitic stereotypes.
How do you think we can get a more productive conversation about Israel and Palestine?
I think really it's to make it a more mainstream peace and human rights issue. I don't think it helps to argue about the nature of Zionism. I believe we need to treat Israel like any other state. And that includes the fact that no state has a right to invade, occupy, colonize its neighbors. No state has a right to engage in indiscriminate bombing into crowded civilian neighborhoods. You know, really, I would say to try to avoid making this an ideological battle and make it much more about human rights, about international law, about peace and conflict resolution, and also to focus on the fact that the United States is making this possible. If it were not for the constant U.S. threat of a veto, the U.N. Security Council could have resolved this situation a long time ago. If it weren't for the military and technological aid we provide Israel, they would not be able to do the kind of damage that they are doing. You know, when the U.S. was supporting the slaughter in El Salvador during the 1980s, you know, the demonstrations weren't in front of the Salvadoran embassy or Salvadoran consulates. They were at U.S. federal buildings because we knew who was ultimately responsible for this. So I say that the key here is to focus on U.S. policy and to make the focus about, you know, peace, human rights, international law, and that kind of thing, and avoid the ideological battles. And even if you, even if you believe that maybe it's too late for a two-state solution, maybe we do have to look at the possibility of a binational state where Israeli Jews and Palestinian Arabs have equal rights or whatever. What's going on right now is, I don't think we need to argue about what that's going to look like or how we get there. I think the immediate thing is to end the occupation, end the colonization, end the bombing. And again, treat Israel as we would any other government, and make clear that U.S. support for what Israel's doing is totally unacceptable. We need to challenge the myth of the United States as being an honest broker. We need to challenge this bipartisan effort to keep the United Nations out of it. The United Nations is formed to address international conflicts like this. The United Nations created Israel in the first place. And for the United States to now say the UN should keep out of it, that's totally unacceptable. So again, I'd say make this let's avoid the ideological battles and focus on, what is going on the ground and the U.S. culpability in the tragedy.
There were just two more things I wanted to ask about. And the first is more of a comment. It's interesting because I think that one can make the argument that anti-Zionism or believing in the one-state solution over the two-state solution, I don't think those things are inherently anti-Semitic, but I actually very much agree with you that the focus needs to be on the people and the civilians and the people who are suffering, not necessarily all these ideological battles first and foremost.
Yeah, they're very, very much so. And I think it's also a language that people can understand. I mean, as I noted earlier, I mean, there are a lot of people who do get defensive about criticism of Israel. I mean, even me, as critical as I am around Israel, as much as I have struggled in solidarity with the Palestinians, going back since my early teens, so I mean, I'm looking 50 years now. If I walk into a room and I hear somebody going on and on and on about all the terrible things Israel's doing, even if I agree with every single thing they're saying, if I don't know this person, there's a part of me that thinks, why is this person saying that really? It's because they're concerned about human rights, international law, war crimes, et cetera, anywhere and everywhere? Or are they using it as an excuse to go after the world's only Jewish state? And, and again, I use the analogy, if there's only one black state in the world, there might be some defensiveness, some concerns about our criticism. So I think we need to be aware of that. And again, that doesn't mean that in any way we be shy about our condemnation of what Israel's doing and the U.S. role in it. But I think one area where I'd say this area is a little different is that I think we do need to have a little bit of sensitivity in that area and to emphasize, these are standards that should be held everywhere. Israel should end its occupation, the same reason that Morocco and Russia should end their occupations. Israel should not keep bombing crowded urban areas in the name of fighting terrorism, the same reason that Syria and Saudi Arabia shouldn't be bombing crowded urban areas in the name of fighting terrorism. But given the extent to which the United States is making Israel's crimes possible, I think even more so than Saudi Arabia and Morocco, I think that, again, behooves us, gives us a special responsibility for making this issue a priority.
And I was just going to add to that, too. I don't want listeners to get the impression that there's not another side to this issue, too, where I think sometimes the term anti-Semite, when you talk about Israel and Palestine, it does get used as a smear term or a snarl word where it's not really valid.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's been used in almost a McCarthyistic way to try to limit dissent, and it has some power. For example, when I think of times that I have had scheduled talks canceled or altered or that kind of thing, it hasn't been by people who were real strong ideological supporters of Netanyahu or anything. They've mostly been kind of good, naive liberals who heard that that professor was doing this as an anti-Semite, and say, oh, we should avoid this kind of thing. And think about it. You know, if I hear a woman accuse somebody of sexism, or a person of color assume somebody is racist, or accuse somebody of racism, and I really don't know what's going on, my default assumption is that the person in the target group is the best judge to do that, right? And I think a lot of people, you know, feel that way about anti-Semitism. Oh, if a Jewish person says that person's anti-Semitic, you know, who am I to judge? They're the person in the target group, you know. So I need to, I should honor that. I should assume that's correct. And this is what's so insidious about this. This is what makes it kind of dangerous. So of course we need to challenge, you know, that as much as possible, where people abuse anti-Semitism to try to silence dissent. And it's bad, not just in terms of silencing even thoughtful critics of Israeli policies and U.S. support for that policy, but also creates a kind of crying wolf phenomenon where, you know, there really are anti-Semites out there. That, I mean, I've heard some pro-Palestinian people saying, oh, he's not anti-Semitic, he's just anti-Zionist. And those people are anti-Semitic as well. It's really unfortunate that anti-Semitism has been weaponized in such a way. So I think you're really right to point out this phenomenon. We need to be aware of it, and we need to be really, really clear where criticism of Israel is anti-Semitic, and very, very clear where criticism of Israel is not anti-Semitic.
The last thing I wanted to ask you about was, it seems like the U.S. response to this has been, especially when they're questioned about, do Palestinians have a right to self-defense? That question gets dodged a lot. And then I think Netanyahu actually said recently that there may be a lot of pressure on us, but we still have the support of the U.S. What do you think this all says about the U.S. complicity and what is happening in that area of the world? And, you know, it is the inability to call out one side indicative of tacit support for one side over the other?
And in certain ways, it goes beyond, simply the usual double standards and hypocrisy we see by the United States and most governments, in fact, in terms of how one treats an allied government versus how one treats an adversarial government that may be engaged in very similar practices. But we are, talking about a country, Israel, who at least among its leadership is overwhelmingly white. And we are talking about the Palestinians, who are people of color. And I think we don't want to, we shouldn't throw around the accusation of racism too loosely, but I really do think it's certainly a factor here. I mean, I think one reason that many Americans identify with Israel is that they are, in many ways, their history is very similar to ours. Israel was founded on some very progressive democratic principles in terms of being an electoral democracy, in terms of being a social democracy, in terms of their economic policies, having these really amazing socialist institutions, like the kibbutzim and the like. Just as the United States was founded on the ideals of the Enlightenment. I mean, we were one of the first democratic republics in the world, and that were founded on our Constitution, our Declaration of Independence, were very, very progressive. But the other side of both of those is that Israel's establishment, in many ways, was that of a colonial settler state that was not just a national liberation movement for Jews. Zionism was also a colonial settler movement. It was both of these. And it involved the dislocation, the forced removal, the ethnic cleansing against much of the indigenous population. But of course, look at our own history with our ethnic cleansing, genocidal wars against the indigenous Americans, and the contradiction that many of our founding fathers, these great idealistic views, democratic views, were also slave owners. And so, both Israel and the United States, have these contradictions. And I think that has a lot to do with the identity. I mean, you've probably seen these ads and PR things that talk about, how progressive Israel is in terms of women's rights, in terms of LGBTQ rights, and et cetera, and compare these to some of these reactionary Arab governments and that kind of thing. And Israel deserves credit for these kind of things, but it doesn't take away from the racism, the oppression, the militarism, and the horrific human rights abuses and war crimes that are also going on. So I think it's important that we recognize these contradictions and call them out. But not just, of course, in Israel, but in our own society as well, obviously.
Do you think that the sort of ice is breaking on all this, by which I mean, you know, like I said, the Biden administration has sort of been lukewarm in responding to questions about do Palestinians have a right to self-defense and things of that nature? They're not really, they don't want to really, it seems like there's not much of a desire to criticize Israel for some of the things it's done in this conflict right now. Do you think that's going to change in the future? Because I feel like we may be hitting some type of critical mass.
This time around, this war compared to what happened in 2009, 2014, the mainstream media, though leaves much to be desired, in my view, is somewhat more balanced than it was before. We're hearing more members of Congress, albeit a minority, who are speaking out more and more. There is definitely a more diversity in opinion than we have seen previously, and the polling data, that I as a political scientist tend to follow, has shown that there is indeed a fair amount of movement in terms of public opinion. And that unfortunately is not reflected in Congress and the White House at this point. But, Congress and the White House are behind public opinion regarding Vietnam, Central America, the arms race, South Africa, and not to mention a number of domestic issues as well over the decades. So, yes, I do think we will in the coming years finally see some real change in U.S. policy. The question is, how many people are going to die? How many people are going to continue to suffer? How long is the bloodshed and oppression going to continue before we do find a real shift in policy? And, in certain ways, actually, it's interesting that there have been a couple of comments by some people in the Biden administration that some of what Israel has done in the in this war, has been excessive or whatever. But, and some members of Congress, including some of those that signed the letter calling for unconditional aid, have said some decent things about it. But, frankly, this reminds me of it's almost the equivalent of giving thoughts and prayers to victims of gun violence while blocking the inaction of sensible gun laws. We need to. So I thought we were starting to see a little bit of finger wagging where maybe there hasn't been before, but it really is not going to make a difference until there's actually action to back it up.
Do you think that action, and I just remembered that I should ask this because I've had different guests comment on this. Does there need to be some type of international action taken or intervention? And I don't mean like military intervention, but what's the role of the international community in all of this? Or is it just that Israel has to make changes from within?
Well, there have been proposals going back nearly 20 years to have, unarmed UN human rights monitors in the occupied territories and things like that. But the United States has vetoed and prevented this kind of thing from happening. As I noted, big bipartisan majority of Congress in January 2017 actually passed a resolution in which they sided with Trump against Obama on the question of Israeli settlements. Incidentally, then Senator Kamala Harris was one of the co-sponsors of this resolution. And among the things mentioned in that non-binding resolution was that the United Nations should have nothing to do with any attempt at resolving the conflict. So obviously, the international community should be involved in. I mean, this is very much within the UN's purview. But at this time in Washington, there's a bipartisan consensus that says the UN should butt out. That's certainly what Israel's position is. And until there's a shift, unfortunately, realistically, there's not much the international community can do. Now, that's in terms of organization states and official policies, where the international community, we think about South Africa, for example, their occupation of Namibia and South Africa itself in terms of the apartheid system, the United States, along with Britain and France, would block the United Nations through their vetoes from imposing sanctions or anything that would force the white South African minority regime to compromise. But what happened was that global civil society came in an international campaign of boycotts, divestment, and sanctions targeted at the South African regime. And eventually this did play an important role in forcing these Western nations to impose targeted sanctions that forced the white minority regime to release Nelson Mandela, legalize the African National Congress, and have negotiations, et cetera, that led to initially independence in Namibia, and then finally an end to majority rule. And even though I have some, you know, certain critiques of certain aspects of the BDS movement, I haven't formally endorsed the call myself. I do think there are certain aspects of that campaign that are really important. And I do think that there is indeed an important role global civil society can play. I mean, if you look at East Timor 25 years ago, that was seen as the ultimate lost cause, right? Because Indonesia's like 200 times bigger in terms of population. They occupied the island. The rebels were down to a few hundred men with these World War II vintage rifles. Any kind of nonviolent civil resistance was brutally crushed. It would seem to be the triumph of realpolitik, you know. But global civil society in the United States, Australia, Canada, Britain, you know, the main foreign backers of Indonesia, ended up effectively shaming these governments into ending their support, their blank check for the regime in Jakarta. And when the pressure finally came on, especially with the economic collapse and the overthrow of Suharto, the Indonesians agreed to allow for a referendum on the fate of the territory. And of course, the East Timorese, by an overwhelming majority, went for independence. So when you talk about involvement of the international community, yes, there are real limits to what governments can do because of the abuse of the veto power, just like Russia's abuse its veto power vis-a-vis Syria. But I do believe there's a role for the international community if you talk about global civil society. And I think that's really where the best hope lies for peaceful resolution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
Well, I want to thank you, Professor Zunis, for coming on Parallax Views. And, you know, for listeners, I have a lot of younger listeners that are just getting into college and university, and they're starting to think about these issues more. And they often will send me emails saying, well, what can I do? So just in closing, what would your advice be to listeners who really want to, you know, do something and get involved with these issues?
Well, I think certainly, on a more immediate level, you know, you can put, pressure on your member of Congress, you know, to, support peace and human rights, the international law, and challenge the Biden administration's policies here, you know, and certainly involvement and various protests, whether it be peace vigils or nonviolent civil disobedience or anything in between. I think certainly educating oneself. I think certainly listening to voices for peace among both Israelis, you know, the more peace-oriented Israelis, such as the Israeli draft resistors and other peace activists, as well as the young Palestinians who don't like Hamas or the Palestinian Authority very much, but recognize that the occupation is the main obstacle, and are organizing themselves. And there's a lot happening in Palestinian civil society, especially in the West Bank. And I think it's really to listen to the voices of those who are most involved. And of course, you know, looking at media outlets, Democracy Now! Has had a great great coverage of this. You know, most of the the more traditional progressive media, like In These Times, the Nation, the progressive magazine, and those, as well as a whole number of progressive blogs and podcasts and things such as yours, I think can all help raise awareness. But I guess the big thing that I would emphasize is that this is an area where the gap between public opinion, especially among young people, and the people who allegedly represent us in Washington, is probably biggest. And that means probably more than any other issue, people's voices need to be heard.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Dr. Stephen Zunis. As always, let me know what you thought about this edition of Parallax Views by dropping me a line on Twitter at @ViewsParallax or by email at parallaxviewspod@protonmail.com. Producers credit shoutouts to Catherine, Nathan, Holland, Brian, Mark, Chase, Zach, Omar, Ted, Rats, Martin, Gary, Amelia, and Mickey. If you'd like your very own producer's credit on each and every edition of Parallax Views, well, consider joining those listeners in supporting me at the $10 or $15 tiers of my Patreon page at patreon.com/parallaxviews. That's patreon.com/parallaxviews. There is also a $1 tier and a $5 tier. Any amount will help. Your support is what keeps this show going. So if you appreciate the work I do, $1, $5, $10, $15 doesn't matter. Please consider supporting me on Patreon at patreon.com/parallaxviews. Again, that's patreon.com/parallaxviews. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. If nothing else, if we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.